Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
The word in Greek that's usually translated as contemplation or to contemplate is theoria or theorein. There are many other translations that could be given to theorein, such as theorizing or speculative thinking. But what all these translations have in common is that they stand in contrast to the kind of thinking that is practical. That's to say, thinking about what is to be done or what is to be made. I mention this because although Father James and I will be both speaking about theorein, we won't be doing so from a merely theoretical perspective. We have a decidedly practical goal, and we wish to come clean about it. Not because we're both bad at hiding, although that's probably true, but because we think our project will go better if you don't feel like you're being manipulated. And the best way to do this, of course, is for us to abandon our attempts at manipulating you and concentrate on getting you on board with our project from the beginning. We think that this is a relatively easy task because you probably wouldn't be on this retreat if all you wanted was a weekend away from Ithaca with free room, free food, and a relatively nice swag bag. The practical goal that Father and I have in mind for you and for ourselves is nothing less than conversion. Conversion away from a particular worldview, which includes a particular understanding of contemplation, and conversion toward a different worldview with a different understanding of and openness to contemplation. We know that we can't force your conversion, especially if you've already had one, but we're going to do everything we can to encourage, or at least not to prevent, the conversion that you haven't had. Our basic plan for bringing this about looks a lot like the Divine Comedy. For those of you who are as similarly ill-versed in literature as I am, Dante, who is both the author of the Divine Comedy and a character in it, is led from hell through purgatory and ultimately to paradise. He has two guides. Virgil leads Dante through hell and purgatory, and Beatrice picks up with paradise. I will be your Virgil, and Father James will be your Beatrice. I will be leading you not through hell and purgatory, but through Aristotle's world and his account of contemplation. Father James, heavenly though his talks might be, will not lead you through paradise, but rather through the world shared by St. Thomas, John Cassian, and the Desert Fathers, and their account of a much fuller kind of contemplation. So that's the big picture. Here's a slightly smaller picture of the structure of my two talks. The first talk that I'll give will be a loose reading of Aristotle's argument, given primarily in his Ethics, for why we should care about contemplation at all. The second talk will be a loose reading of some other Aristotelian texts, primarily the De Anima, that describes what contemplation is like and what we need to do if we wish to contemplate Aristotelian style. I've entitled both of these talks Peripatetic Therapy because both talks will be therapeutic in attempting to take seriously some aspect of Aristotle's account of contemplation. So let me say a brief word about each of those phrases. First, what in the world is peripatetic therapy? My talks will be peripatetic in two senses. First, they'll be peripatetic in the sense that they will follow Aristotle. The followers of Aristotle were called, even in Aristotle's own day, peripatetics, because they would literally walk around as they philosophized. Second, the talks will be peripatetic because they will imitate Aristotle's philosophical approach of metaphorically and thoughtfully walking around whatever object was given to his attention. The talks will also be therapeutic, that is to say, healing, in two senses. The talks will heal us, first, of our ignorance of Aristotle's world and his account of contemplation. On its own, of course, being ignorant of the Aristotelian world isn't really a wound. You, very rightfully, didn't come here thinking, my relationship with the Lord and my understanding of myself in his sight are really hampered by my ignorance of Aristotle. And if you did come here thinking that, please let me know. Ignorance of Aristotle's world and his view of contemplation can be a wound, though, if our ignorance of Aristotle causes us to confuse or to conflate his view of contemplation with a significantly different Christian view of contemplation. So, these two Aristotelian talks will heal us indirectly of our ignorance of the view of contemplation held by St. Thomas and the Desert Fathers. We'll be able to take seriously the distinctively Christian aspects of contemplation because we will have taken seriously the alternative. The talks have the potential to heal us, in a second sense, of any disproportionate attraction that we might have to Aristotle's account of contemplation. From a distance, Aristotle's account of contemplation is breathtaking. It has the potential to be so attractive that it might distract us from looking at other accounts. One way to deal with this distraction is just to turn away from it when people that you trust say, oh, but St. Thomas's account is even better. If you can do this with ease, then feel free to leave and skip the next talk as well. If you're the sort, though, that will always be wondering what you left behind, stick around. Looking closer at Aristotle's accounts will allow you to appreciate them more accurately for what they are and for where they fall short. This brings us to the second phrase, taking things seriously. In general, taking things seriously means not contenting yourself with knowing merely the surfaces of things, with merely being able to use the right words, or with merely knowing how to distinguish one thing from another. Taking things seriously means attempting to strip away from our perception of things any prejudgments or lenses that prevent us from seeing things clearly, as they are, and not merely as we would like them to be. Taking seriously the guy with the mullet and the Boston Red Sox jersey on means not thinking of him merely as a Red Sox fan or as a redneck. Since it's either really difficult or impossible just to will yourself not to be content with knowing the surfaces of things or trying to strip away unhelpful lenses, there are a few tricks that we can enlist to help us try to see beneath the surfaces and behind our lenses. One thing we can do is we can turn our attention to the image that we have of a particular thing and then playfully tweak that image until we can distinguish between what really belongs to it and then what we've just hastily assumed it to be. This is what's done in every episode of The Twilight Zone, in all of G.K. Chesterton's novels, and in the iconic Christmas classic, It's a Wonderful Life. All of these give us vivid images of how things could be but aren't. Only once we have tweaked these images can we appreciate or adjust the images that we have of things as they are. We can place these two images beside each other and begin to put words to the differences. This is more than merely having words. Another trick that we can enlist if we wish to take something seriously is to imagine that the thing is being proposed to us for action. Thus, to take a back tuck seriously means not merely having the name back tuck or a few descriptions of back tucks, but also imagining a back tuck in enough articulated detail and maybe asking enough questions of someone who can actually do one so that our image can serve for us as a practical guide. And a little closer to the topic at hand, to take contemplation seriously means not merely understanding and being able to repeat what others have said about it, but imagining it and asking enough detailed questions so that we will be able to do it if we wish to. That's to say, if our taking it seriously has proven it worthy of our continued attention. Here's a third and final example of imaginatively taking things seriously. When I was preparing this talk, I imagined that some of you would be at least partly skeptical of my approach, of my taking things seriously as a therapy approach. I imagined what questions and reservations you would have that would be barriers to your taking seriously this talk. One of the questions I imagined at least one of you asking is this: how do I know that taking Aristotelian contemplation seriously is worth my time and effort? And for that matter, how do I know that taking anything seriously is worth my time and effort? Does anyone want to claim that?
No. Oh, wrong.
Okay. Well, my response to that question that you're not asking, which I think is still worth asking, even if you didn't actually come here asking it, is this. You don't know whether contemplation, Aristotelian style or elsewhere, is worth taking seriously until you've tried to do it. You can't take everything seriously, and you shouldn't take nothing seriously. To take nothing seriously means not to take yourself seriously. And although that sounds kind of fun, it's really just a way of saying that you don't take your own goodness seriously. So the best option, from my view, seems to be this. Take seriously all and only those things that people whom you trust and whom you wish to be like take seriously. And to link this back to the talk that I am at long last about to begin, after a very long introduction, take Aristotle's account of contemplation seriously, at the very least because St. Thomas took it seriously, and because St. Thomas was someone who was not only smart, but holy. Now begins the real talk. Peripatetic Therapy 1, taking seriously Aristotle's world and the role of contemplation in it. This talk will be a loose retelling of Aristotle's argument displayed in his Ethics that contemplation is the most fulfilling human activity. I say loose because I'm going to attempt to turn Aristotle's texts, which are effectively a set of lecture notes, into something that resembles a narrative. The lecture notes sometimes go into detail about particular questions and sometimes say how particular answers relate to others, but it's usually left up to the reader to figure out how everything fits together. This fitting together is what I'm going to try to do. This is going to require ignoring a lot of detail and experimenting with reordering. This is to say, I'm going to do something that is academically irresponsible. It's worth it, though, because it has the possibility of being intellectually and practically fruitful. I'll try not to say anything academically reprehensible, but I ask your pardon if I do. If you're familiar enough with Aristotelian details, please listen to this talk in the same mode as someone who's very familiar with scripture would watch an episode of The Chosen. If my loose retelling of Aristotle's account of contemplation had a trailer, it would lead off like this. You are the kind of being that is most fulfilled by contemplating your own goodness. Dun, dun, dun. Epic music. On my read, Aristotle leads us to this conclusion, not so much by giving us a propositional argument as by pointing to features of our own experience, and in particular, by pointing to our experience of desiring, enjoying, acting, not enjoying. These experiences that Aristotle describes, although somewhat familiar to us, take place in a world that is somewhat unfamiliar to us. So I'm going to begin my loose retelling of Aristotle's argument by describing Aristotle's world as he understood it. What I mean by a world is a space whose dimensions are determined by my awareness and by my activity. I am the center of my world. The outer limits and the inner contours of my world are determined by my beliefs about myself, my beliefs about the beings with which I interact or am aware. My world is similar to yours to the extent that we have similar beliefs about ourselves and about what else exists. Aristotle's world, like our world, is principally determined by his beliefs about three things. First, God. Second, other human beings, and third, himself. As I alluded to in the introduction, our tour of Aristotle's world is going to look something like the tour of hell that Virgil gave to Dante. We'll start by examining Aristotle's beliefs about God as the outermost circle or horizon of his world. We'll then move to examine Aristotle's beliefs about other people, insofar as they have some influence on our imitation of God as an ideal. Then we'll end by recounting Aristotle's observations about the desires that are located at each of our cores. We'll find, in examining these desires, our desires, that the contemplation of our own goodness is the most fulfilling activity in which we could engage. To begin, then, the outermost horizon of Aristotle's world is God. God, understood not as a Homeric deity, nor merely as a projection of an ideal, but as a real entity living an ideal life. God's life is ideal because all he does and is thinking, thinking, thinking. To rephrase that, he is mind as a subject, and what he does is mind as an activity, himself as an object. On the surface, mind minding itself might not sound terribly engaging, but if you think about what it would be like to actually be a mind minding itself perpetually, perhaps it will become a little more attractive. This is a life of eternal, unremitting enjoyment. God engages eternally in an activity that's enjoyable. On Aristotle's reading, it's triply enjoyable. First, because it's satisfying to engage in any activity. That's to say, it's satisfying to do something rather than nothing. It's satisfying to think rather than not to think. Second, it's further satisfying to think of someone or something that you love and desire, whether the thing desired is present or not. And third, it's most satisfying to think of someone that you love, especially when that thinking makes the beloved present. This is to say, it's most satisfying to behold the beloved in its presence. God experiences this triple enjoyment perpetually because he doesn't do anything except mind himself, whom he loves. He doesn't have to do anything to lead up to this activity of thinking, and there's also no part of his thinking that is for the sake of some other part. Moreover, he never gets bored because he never thinks of anything which he could compare himself as activity. And also because he thinks of the whole of himself without moving his attention from one part to another, because he's partless. This is what Aristotle's God does and is. And in case you're tempted to fill in some of the gaps of this account with what you know about the Trinitarian God, it's particularly tempting to think, thinking, thinking, thinking. Is that Father, Son, and Holy Spirit? Is that holy, holy, holy? No. And so in case you're tempted, it's worth noting that for Aristotle, God is not a creator. He isn't responsible for bringing anything into existence. Things didn't need to be brought into existence because in Aristotle's world, they existed eternally. God is responsible, though, for eternally drawing things into activity. God draws things to activity simply by being desired. He moves things passively by being attractive, by being an ideal. This is to say, in Aristotle's book, every activity of every existing thing is nothing other than an imitation of God. Thus, every individual thing acts to keep itself as it is, in imitation of God's eternity. Rocks try to stay as big as they are for as long as possible. Palm tree forms try to keep their hold on palm tree matter. Sensible beings, like aardvarks, try to perpetuate their own enjoyment by engaging in sensually desirable acts. And human beings, which Aristotle suggests could be called rational desirers, try to maximize and perpetuate not only the quantity of enjoyable activities, but also the quality. God, for his part, is entirely unaware of all of these acts of imitation. He's not aware of us at all, and thus can neither help us nor punish us. Why not? He's happily busy thinking about himself. And since he didn't make us, there's also no sense in which we, either individually or collectively, are contained in his conception of himself. God, then, as the farthest horizon or the outermost circle of the Aristotelian world, functions as an ideal toward which we are drawn. God doesn't impede our imitation of him in any way. All he does is attract us by being what he is. It's worth underscoring that this is the only thing that God does in the Aristotelian world. There's nothing that God does either for us or to us. He neither helps us nor hinders us in our attempts to imitate him, and he makes no demands or requests of us, either for his sake or for ours. Correlatively, there's nothing that we can do, need to do, or should do for God. Our imitation of him, to say our attempts of being fulfilled as he is fulfilled, aren't for his sake, but for ours. God doesn't care about our happiness, but we do. Let's move on to a more interior circle of Aristotle's world, to a region where we are variously helped and hindered in our attempts to imitate God's perfect fulfillment. So in Aristotle's world, what I'm calling the circle of others, is where the vast majority of our happiness is determined. Other people determine our ability to successfully imitate God's perpetual enjoyment in two ways. First, and most obviously, other people both provide for our needs and involve us in providing for their needs, as well as for communal needs. Aristotle just takes it as a brute fact that we're social beings, and as such, there are certain things that we have to do to remain in existence as social beings. Think, those who would not work should not eat. We do these things, not because they're enjoyable, but just because we have to. So accordingly, one way that others can impede our ability to imitate God's happiness is by placing upon us things that we have to do. We can, of course, make these things into a greater obstacle to our happiness, either by doing them badly or by taking them more seriously than they deserve. Ideally, we just do them well and then get onto the business of doing the things that we want to do simply because they're enjoyable. And a brief parenthetical remark. I think there's a significant difference between having to do something and then believing that we should do something. In Aristotle's world, social necessities are have to. They're not shoulds. My really unofficial hunch is that the language of should enters into our world with Immanuel Kant. But that would be a very different set of talks. Close parentheses. The second way that others, in the circle of others, can advance or impede our imitation of God is by modeling and coaching us how to imitate God's perpetual enjoyment. This modeling and coaching can be done either well or poorly, and it makes no small difference which kind of modeling and coaching we receive. When it comes to noting the role that others play in our happiness, Aristotle says nothing about whether our parents please us or give us pleasing things. Instead, he makes the potentially devastating observation that if our parents didn't model and coach us in good habits in our youth, it's unlikely that we will ever fully acquire them in adulthood. This is significant, since to the extent that we don't have good habits, our potential to enjoy ourselves maximally is limited. Aristotle explains his claim something like this. That person will be maximally pleased who is able not only to recognize the relative goodness of things for himself and to desire those things in proportion to their goodness, but also to act on those desires without struggle. Let's have an example. Most of us are raised knowing that we probably ought to enjoy a good game of chess and that we probably oughtn't gobble up the plate of brownies when it's put out for a visitor. But even if we both know how we ought to act And even if we act accordingly, it's still possible that we go through life with the dual pain of never really enjoying chess and never really getting to indulge in the brownies that are put out in the time and the quantity that we desire. So it matters a great deal whether we are raised not only to recognize the relative goodness of things, but also whether we are allowed to desire and coached to desire each thing in proportion to its goodness. That concludes the circle of others. On to the center and the final aspect of Aristotle's world. At the center of the Aristotelian world is the self. At the center of the Aristotelian self is desire. And at the center of our desires is one ultimate desire. That desire is the desire to enjoy as much as possible the life of God. Aristotle doesn't come right out and claim that our core desire is to be like God. But ever true to his peripatetic approach, he walks us through the kinds of desires that we have and observes a hierarchy and a likeness to God's life. Of all the things that we desire to do, some things, like paying rent, are desirable only because they fulfill some need. Aristotle calls these instrumental goods, because they're valuable to us only as instruments for some further good, like not getting evicted. Other activities, like eating asparagus, are desirable both because they fulfill some need, like maintaining physical health, and also because they're potentially enjoyable in themselves. Aristotle calls these intermediate goods. Still other activities, like being with a friend, are desirable not for fulfilling any further need or desire, but only for themselves. They're ultimate goods because every other good is for them, and they are for nothing further. It should be evident that our enjoyment of these ultimate goods is a closer imitation of God's perpetual enjoyment of himself than our enjoyment of either merely instrumental goods or intermediate goods would be. It's only when we're enjoying an ultimate good that our enjoyment continues without diminishing. It doesn't conclude simply because we've done what we set out to do, like not getting evicted, or because we're no longer able to do what we set out to do, because we ran out of asparagus. Let's try to get a little more specific, though. In what particular activity could we possibly engage that would allow us to enjoy an ultimate good without diminishment or dependence on others? In Aristotle's mind, the only real candidate for the most desirable and sustainable human activity is thinking, or perhaps knowing. I don't take Aristotle to mean that we'll be happy just thinking anything or knowing anything. I take him to mean that there is a specific object that we can thoughtfully attend to that will reproduce in us, as far as possible, God's threefold delight. Remember that God is delighted because his thinking is uninterrupted, because he is thinking of what he loves, and because his thinking makes his beloved present. So, following this criteria, thinking about triangles won't make us happy, since they're not really beloved. Thinking about God won't make us happy, since he's not present to us in our thinking. The only remaining option seems to be that I will be most happy when I am thinking of my own goodness. My own goodness is intimately present to me as long as I attend to it, and it is surely beloved to me. Otherwise put, I will be happiest if I know and rest in knowing that I am doing all that I should for my own happiness, that I am loving myself and that I'm aware of this love. Put even more simply, if you wish to be happy, Aristotelian style, become good and then contemplate your goodness. I'd like to conclude by highlighting, for your comments, three Aristotelian claims that I suspect sound shocking to anyone in the contemporary secular world. In general, I believe it's worthwhile to take a closer look at whatever shocks us, because both shockingly hideous and shockingly delightful claims are potential reasons either to confirm our beliefs or to convert to others. One shocking Aristotelian claim is that happiness is maximal enjoyment and not merely doing what you should. In Aristotle's world, there's no shame either in wanting to be happy or in actually being happy. This is because being happy is not a matter of behave, quit doing what brings you pleasure, and do what you're supposed to do, but rather, unless you behave in this way, you'll miss out on maximal enjoyment. A second shocking Aristotelian claim is that there's probably no hope of your enjoying contemplation if you don't already enjoy it. This is because, in Aristotle's world, there's no one who can help you by getting inside you to change that in which you take delight, to change the order of your desires, or to give you a new desire. And a third and final shocking Aristotelian claim is that my happiness is unbudgingly mine. It's my activity of thinking about my goodness, which I love for my sake. The appealing side of this is that it seems to free me from any sense of victimhood. It calls forth my agency and it invites me to take responsibility for myself and my happiness. The unappealing side is that it is horridly self-focused, self-reliant, and isolating. The isolation doesn't seem to be pierced by Aristotle's suggestion that I could, in theory, think about the goodness of a friend. A friend is called by Aristotle another self. But the reason why I would want to contemplate the goodness of a friend is probably because he reminds me of me and because I love myself. I love myself, but I would also love your comments.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.